I am an alcoholic, and my problem is Bob Prieto. I want to let you know that I'm a stand-in. The speaker that was asked tonight somehow didn't make it. I hope they're all right. It's always a pleasure to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sponsor in Japan who used to say, "I can't think of any other place I'd rather be right now than at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." And you know, sometimes I may not feel like that earlier on in the evening, but by the time I get my butt into a meeting and sit down, I know I'm in the right place. But by the grace of God, Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the power that I found in this program, I haven't found it necessary to have a drink for 4,298 days, one day at a time. That's not a big deal for anybody out there, and it shouldn't be. But it's an awfully big deal for me. I am not quite sure tonight why I put a shirt and tie on, or at least I didn't know why until I got here. And it wasn't because Denise or Bruce or anybody decided to allow me the privilege to share with you tonight. It was because I was supposed to have a tie and a shirt on to watch one of my babies share tonight and to see some dear friends of mine. One of them received a birthday cake, and the other one is my AA sister, and I haven't seen her for years, and I love her very dearly. Not that anybody would ever throw this book out there and tell you to read it, but on lines 13 and 14 of page 58 that we read all the time, it says our stories disclosed in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. So I'm not going to bore you to death with a whole lot of what I used to be like. I think every time we get an alcoholic up here to share their experience, strength, and hope, they tell you part of my story. If you've ever read any of Bill's story or more about alcoholism or any of that, you will know more of my story. And the bottom line is I am an alcoholic, not because of what I drank, when I drank, where I drank, how much I drank. I am simply an alcoholic because alcohol became the solution to my living problem. I seem to have found out at a very early age that if I had a drink, things would change. I don't know if they changed for anybody else, but I would think that the people in this room, they changed. I understand that's probably why you're here. I want to welcome the newcomers. You are the lifeblood of this program. Lots of times you'll walk into meetings and you may not understand what we're talking about, but depending on where we're at in our sobriety, you mean so very much to us. Sometimes, you know, if we're self-obsessed and we're not doing very well in, working the program, we can look at somebody really desperate coming in and say, "Whew, gee, I remember that," you know. And I'm still very glad that I'm not there anymore. But something else, if you listen to what happens in these rooms, there are miracles that happen in these rooms, and one of the miracles that you will see and hear is that miracle of laughter. And we sit here and we tell such sad, tragic tales about how our life was just literally going down the drain one day at a time. And we can sit here and share that with other human beings in the same condition, and we can find something humorous in it. And what we find humorous in it is our salvation in this program. We find out that there is a solution. And that solution is a recovery from the disease of alcoholism by the practice of this program, you know, in concert with a loving God, a power greater than yourself, whatever you want to call it, that you can share your sobriety with. I won't bore you with this long drunkalogue. I can tell you that my parents, my grandparents on both sides of my family were European stock, so that naturally means that they drank lots of wine and they drank lots of booze, and they used to make it all, you know, and every time you sat down at dinner you had some of it. But once again, I'm no different from any other garden variety alcoholic. I found that when I had a drink, my perception would change. Things became okay, you know. And if I would sit around and get overserved, they'd get better than okay, you know. And they'd get okay until I wasn't okay. I was going to tell you this really colorful, wonderful, you know, adventurous, James Bondish kind of story, but I was blacked out for so much of it, I don't remember. So that's just the way my drinking was. I started real young, and we drank, and I came up in the streets of New York, and I don't want to bore you to death with all that, you know, that kind of stuff, but, you know, it's no different than a drunk that came from a mansion, you know. I had questions that there were no answers for, or I had answers for questions nobody wasn't asking, or I just felt like I didn't fit in kind of stuff. And if anybody out there understands what I'm talking about, then I guess you're in the right place. But I drank about it, and I drank at it, and I drank over it, and the drinking worked, and the drinking worked for a real long time. And just like Eric, I thought I'd find fun in adventure and defend freedom and the Constitution. And I joined the Marine Corps in 1966, in February, and off to war I went. And now this is alcoholic. I knew that in and of myself, I could probably get all them little rice burners and just wipe them all out. First time them bastards started shooting at me, I hit the ground and said, "Whoa, they're serious." And you know, when people are shooting at you, hey. So, you know, it's just like being in jail. If nobody's been in jail, you can get booze and some of this other stuff, but you can get booze any place, you know. And in combat, you know, we'd figure out a way to get some stuff either from the villagers or whatever, or we'd make our own, or we would, I got into drinking aqua velva shave lotion. I liked the color of it. It was blue and it was cool looking. And the only thing I can tell you about drinking that stuff is that when you puke, you smell better, you know. And but if you ever decide to join the military, specifically the Marine Corps or any of the infantry units, and go out in the field and want to sneak around on the enemy, it's not good if you smell like a big bottle of aqua velva. They know you're there. Go on, get the Marine, you know. You know, that's the way the drinking was. The drinking was insane. You know, I guess I'm like any other alcoholic that I know, and that's I'm a compulsive obsessive. I was diagnosed one time as a manic depressive. You know, and that's just the way I went through life. I can remember. What time do I got to shut up, Bruce? Okay. I can remember one time I didn't go to my junior prom because I beat up my girlfriend's father. We were playing poker at his house, and he was losing. And then I didn't go to my senior prom because I beat up that girlfriend's father. And the only reason I had a fight with him was because he said, "You're not taking her to the prom," because I had made an ass out of myself some other place and embarrassed his daughter and stuff. So I beat him up, and then I didn't go to the prom. But that's the way I used to react. I was one of those real idiot drunks, you know. If you said hi and I didn't know you, I'd hit you. You know, if you said hi and I had a drink and I didn't feel like it, I'd hit you. You know. But, so that's just the way it was, and I joined the Marine Corps, and I did all that weird stuff, and the Marine Corps was not the answer, but as Eric was saying so succinctly before, you may not believe this, but the Marine Corps would allow you to drink just about anything, anywhere, anytime, so long as you would go out and shoot things. And during that time, there was a big commodity for us. I mean, there was a big reason for us to go out and shoot things, you know. I lost my father over there. That's another story. My father was an alcoholic. He was a full-blown alcoholic. I come up in a—I don't want to tell you this sad, maudlin tale, but I came up in one of those dysfunctional homes, and that's not a reason I drank either. I just started imitating the old man. But you know, if anybody out there, especially newcomers, if you came out of a family that was just as goddamn nuts as some of the stuff that's going on that brought you into this room, then you're in the right place. My father was a hitter. He used to love to beat up my mother. He used to love to beat us up. He did that. He used to do that every time he got drunk. And he did that till I was 16, and then him and I stood toe-to-toe, and I knocked the shit out of him. And, you know, it's not a requirement for you to be here. But, you know, if that touches base with some of you people, then you're in the right place. Don't do that. I'm going to hit the deck here. That sounds like a goddamn gunshot. And, oh, it used to be real bad when I used to jump over bushes and stuff when cars backfire. When I beat my father up when I was 16 years old, I beat this guy up with 16 years of rage for being such a shit of an alcoholic in that house you know, and trashing everybody all the time. And at the same time I was hitting this man with 16 years of rage and fury, I was saying, this cannot be true. This is my father. I'm supposed to love this guy. This guy is supposed to love me back. This is supposed to be like a family thing. And I don't know if you've ever been in those situations, but those things will rip the guts right out of you, you know. And, you know, I learned real early in life to cut off all feeling, cut emotions, do not make emotional bonds with people. You take them hostage. If you're going to take them anyway, you take them hostage. And you eat them up before they eat you up, and on and on. So, you know, that's what I grew up in, and I got to a point where I thought I'd share all that wonderfulness with another human being. So, one night in a bar, I was minding my own business, and I was being overserved again, and she walked in with her girlfriend, and I went over and I casually sauntered up to her in my most elegant manner and, could you care to dance? And she looked at her girlfriend and says, who the hell, you know, and she danced, and what I understand is I slipped and fell a bunch of times and stuff, and it was pretty slippery out there, you know. The next day this woman got a phone call, and she couldn't understand, one, how I got to call her, until later on when I got to meet her and pursue her and stuff. I had told her that any good drunk, you see, I didn't know I was an alcoholic, any good drunk that is attracted to someone of the opposite sex will be able to borrow a pen off the bartender and carve her phone number into his forearm. So when I saw this bloody scar on my arm that had numbers, I figured that meant something. But that's how I met her. So we did that, and my wife and I, Susan, were going to go off into the sunset and have just a wonderful life. And I continued to drink the way I always drank, and my drinking has always been selfish. My drink of choice is free, and if you've got the time, so do I. I detest intensely those people at the bar when you're kind enough to buy them around and they don't reciprocate. Now that's uncivil. It's antisocial. And it's the last time I'll ever buy them bastards a drink. But I would sit around and do that kind of stuff. Social drinking got too expensive. If there's anybody out there that knows about that, social drinking is extremely expensive if you drink the way I drink. And the guy says, well, how much do you drink? I say, well, what time do you close? You know? And, you know, or how much money you got? People, if you're new, if you're wondering about if you're an alcoholic or not, ask yourself one question. Have I been, or am I presently at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? You know? Like, normal people don't come here. You know, and if you're wondering about, you know, how much you drank and when you drank and all that stuff, once again, I have to reflect on my own career, and it's not what I drank, where I drank, when I drank. It's why I drank. And that's because alcohol produced that effect for me that allowed me to just to continue to go on. And, you know, and you would drink when you were sad, and you drank when you're happy, and you drink because the sun comes up and because it goes down, and, you know, you just drink because it becomes a solution. You know, you don't have to process a whole lot of stuff if you're an active alcoholic and you're drinking. I mean, why work through a goddamn problem? You know, it's too painful to do that. I'll have a double. You know? Yes, no. You throw that drink down, we'll take care of that later. You know what I mean? But I'm not really sure, but that's the way I always drank, and I had a good teacher, the old man. The old man, at least that man, God rest him, taught me. He said, if you're going to get stinko drunk all the time, he said, what you got to do the next day is you got to eat. You got to eat. And I don't know, that's probably why I'm so healthy today, you know. I used to eat, sick, drunk, or not, you know. I'd still eat, you know. But we're moving right along into marriage and the career and the military, and I got out. I was so stupid. My first enlistment, I joined for 4 years. I spent over 3.5 years overseas, in combat and some other stuff, and came back. I spent more time in recruit training than I did in the States. And I came back, and they said, hey, you want to get out early? And I said, oh, hey, that's cool, because it was close to Christmas. I didn't know you could just, like, go on leave and come back, you know? I was a goddamn sergeant. I was decorated for, you know, all this other stuff, but I didn't know that you could, like, Well, like, can I re-enlist and go on leave and come back? Nobody told me that. They had 550,000 Marines at that time, and they were trying to, you know, thin the ranks. So I said, okay, cool. So I get out, and I did a stint as a civilian for 6 years, 9 months, and 14 days. And I was a union carpenter. I was a tractor-trailer driver. I was an insurance agent. I did a bunch of things, and I did them well. But now, this is not for everybody out there, but this is just for people who are like me, alcoholics like me. Have you ever been at a place and you ever picked a job up like that and you started really knocking it out and doing good and you get all these kudos and you get the pay raises and, you know, they just think you're just the slickest thing since sliced bread. You know, when you get your paycheck and you go home, there's nobody looking and you say, if them son of a guns really knew who I was, this ain't it either. Or, they're only telling me that. I don't know about anybody else, but I knew that whatever it was I was doing, one, wasn't good enough, and two, there's always somebody watching over my shoulder, cause three, somebody else is... Just for the alcoholics out there like me, there were two things that I was afraid of, because most of my life was just fear in and of itself. And the two things I was afraid of was, one, I had something that you wanted and you were going to try to take it away from me, or two, you had something I wanted and God damn it, I couldn't get it. I used to drink over that all the time. There's a lot of things that go on in an alcoholic mind like mine, especially when I'm drinking. And most of what went on in my mind from my very first waking minute until I closed my eyes was fear. And it was fear that I wasn't getting dealt from the top of the deck. I wasn't getting mine. Somebody else, you know, on and on. Wow, wow, wow. You know, and, well, I don't know, maybe it's not like that for anybody else out there, but that's the way it was for me. You know, and I made my mind up a long time ago, you weren't going to cut me out. I'm one of them kind of alcoholics that would get up in the morning and put his goddamn armor on, because I knew that I had a battle on my hands every day, and I was fighting you and the rest of the world. I was fighting them, you know. Could never find a lot of them, but I knew they were out there. So, moving right along, in my career, I got out and I was doing those things, and kids started popping up, you know, whoop, whoop, you know, and I said, oh, geez, another one, my God. And so we had kids now, we had a, you know, we had this insane family, and I got to preface, if you're an alcoholic like me and you came up in a dysfunctional family, and you ever thought about your parent or your parents and say, I'll never grow up to be like that son of a bitch. Try looking in the mirror one day and finding out that you are exactly like the old man. Except I'm not a hitter. I don't believe in hitting women or children. I don't hit women, and I don't think that children, other than, you know, a little spank on the butt kind of stuff. But I looked in the mirror one day and I had found out that I was my old man. And you want to talk about a terrifying experience? Holy mackerel. So the Arabs were screwing around with our oil back in the 70s. And I said, well, I think we need to go to war and kill ragheads so we can get our oil. So I knew that was coming as I sat at the pump, you know, from midnight. Did anybody remember the great oil wars when you were sitting in front of the pumps? In New York, it was hell. I used to sit there with a pistol, 12 o'clock midnight, go to sleep, wait till the gas station opened up because, you know, 2 hours before the gas station opened up, there was a mile, you know, there was a mile-long line. And when a guy, you know, try to cut in front of you, you just stick your .357 in his face and say, back up, chump. But I figured, hey, I'd just as soon kill the Arabs and get the oil rather than kill my own compatriots. So I went back in the Marine Corps. I think it's a great mentality if you're going to be in the military. But so I went back in, and I've been in active duty military and since then, since 76. And things for alcoholics in those days in the military were great. We didn't have all this political correct crap. We didn't have people looking over your shoulder all the time like, is he out at the bar again? You know, all you had to do is drag your body in and be, you know, dressed and standing up semi-conscious and stuff for the morning formation. You know, and then the first sergeant would say, put your stuff out, put your stuff on, go out in the field and kill. And you go, yeah, kill, you know. Yeah. And in 1970, I think it was, I think it was about 80, 81. I went overseas and came back, and I'm going to get through with this real quick. I came back, and there were some people that were thinking that I was getting real strange. Now, I got to tell you, in the meantime, I stopped being an infantry guy, and I went to what they call explosive ordnance disposal. I'm on a bomb disposal team, and that means if they drop it, shoot it, launch it, throw it, you know, whatever, and it doesn't go boom, doesn't blow up, me and my guys go down there, and we take these things apart. Pretty goddamn scary to have a drunk with a wrench on a bomb. Now, I would say it would be real scary, except that all the other guys on my job were just as big a drunks as me.
Hey, give me a goddamn wrench. No, leave it alone. Hey.
But that's a military secret. Don't let that out. But in 81, some people thought I was having a kind of a hard time with reality. And they sent me to see this shrink at the hospital on the base, and I seen the guy, and he said, "Well," he says, "Staff Sergeant, you're kind of wrapped pretty tight there, bud." He said, "You're wound up like a $2 switch watch." And I said, "No." So he says, "Well," he says, "here's what we're going to do for you. This guy is a colonel. Any military types know what I mean. He's a captain, 06 colonel." He says, "I'm going to send you up to the stress analysis clinic in Oakland." I says, "Captain, you don't understand. You see this? I'm a staff non-commissioned officer in the Marine Corps. I got a platoon of people. I got to take, you know, we got a job to do." He says, "Well, let me tell you, Slick. You either go up there for the 6 or 8 weeks and either make the program and get kicked out of the military, or you come and lay on my couch for it. An hour a day for the rest of your life." And I said, "Well, I think going to Oakland is a good idea." And they sent me up there, and I did this thing, and I'm not going to get into psychobabble, but they found out about my inner child, and they found out about my terrible childhood, and my dysfunctional family, and all of that stuff. And I had a laugh because I knew I was in trouble when they put me on the when they took me off the plane, and I was supposed to get into the ambulance from Travis Air Force Base to Oakland, and they put me in this white wraparound jacket. And they're asking you questions, you know, and you're going, "Yes, no, no, yes." But the whole time, I got to tell you, the whole time I was there, if you're an alcoholic like me, I'm going to throw this just as one thought out. Have you ever thought in your drinking that, "I'm just goddamn nuts, that's all"? You know, if your life was like this, you'd be nuts too. Well, I depended on that stuff. I really thought I was nuts. And I get there, and they put me through this whole process. They not even asked me about drinking, and I God's my truth, God's honest truth. He says, "How much do you drink?" I said, "No more than anybody else." And I wasn't lying. I was talking about people I knew, you know. And but you know, I never got real with them. Like it says in this book, I never got real with people that wanted to help me, well-meaning people. I never got real with them about my drinking. Because drinking was my solution. I don't know about you. Drinking was my solution. So all of a sudden, I go through this 6, 7, 8 week thing. This therapy. It was mental therapy, and I got de-stressed and stuff. And they gave me a certificate. They gave me a certificate, and I got it at home. It says, "Bob is not nuts." Now, you might feel good about getting one of those, but goddamn it, I was terrified. Because what happened was, a group of professional people took that crutch right out from underneath me. You know, because that was a big cop out of mine. "I'm just goddamn nuts. That's why I do what I do." And they said, no. "You're not nuts, pal. We don't know what it is, but you're not nuts." So I went out there and I said, "Oh, geez, you know." So I had to think about it, and if you're a thinker like me, you have to drink about what you have to drink while you think. So I drank for another couple of years, and I'm going to go back real quick. When I was 21 years old, I was on it was in the Mediterranean on a cruise, and I went out to celebrate my 21st birthday, and it got so bad, I drank so much that I got into a slight altercation with the shore patrol, and was cordially invited back to the ship by the six of them. And but what happened was I was so overtoxified. You know how you read in the papers where kids on a bed will drink a fifth of booze and they die because they're overtoxified and their body can't process it? Well, I was 21 years old, and I went into an alcoholic coma, And I was so intoxicated that my heart stopped, and I died down there in sick bay, and they resuscitated me, and I was in a coma for 3.5 days or so. And when I came back, and I just want to, you know, I just want to mention this to the arrogant drunk out there, the arrogant drunk like me. When I opened my eyes, a good friend of mine was a combat corpsman with me in Vietnam, and we had known each other. We went back a long way. We were blood brothers. He said, "My Christ," he said, "Bob, you died 4 days ago." I said, "What?" He says, "You died. You know, your heart stopped. They had to resuscitate you. It was, you know." And I looked at him, I said, "I'm here now." You know? But you know what I'm saying? It's so goddamn arrogant when you're 21 and you're an alcoholic and you're a combat veteran and you're like Superman. You know, you're invincible and stuff. And I couldn't even be grateful. I couldn't even grasp onto that little straw and be grateful enough to say, "My God, thank you for bringing me back." Well, I didn't know it at that time. You know, and that's when I was 21. Well, I kept drinking and I kept drinking and drinking, and things just got the way they get to be for alcoholics. And I was out in the desert doing a job with another guy, and if there's anybody out there that likes to quantify numbers or stuff like that, the end of my drinking, I used to drink about a 9-pack or a 12-pack a day after work, and that was maintenance, okay? But my drinking on my own time, when I was out there by myself in the desert, out in 29 Palms, I was drinking a liter bottle of tequila a night with a quarter orange juice. You need vitamin C. It keeps you going. But I was drinking one of them big goddamn liter and a half bottles a day. And I stayed, and that's all I was. I was in a fog, and I was working with explosives and unexploded bombs and shit that'll kill you that quick. But I got to a point where I really took a look at myself, and I said, "What a sorry son of a bitch." And I'm not a gun freak, but I'm familiar with weapons, and I have my own. And I sat in my motel room in the dark, and I sat there, and I was in the poor me's. And I don't know if you're drunk like I am, but, you know, when you get into those cups, you know, and you're really sitting there in that pitiful bullshit, thinking about what a lousy, yeah, you know, and life stinks like a big crap sandwich, you know, and you're just getting up, taking another bite of it. I sat there and I played with my pistol for a minute, and then I threw it up to my head, and I said, "Why don't you just take yourself out, Slick? You'd be doing a lot of people a favor." So I went and I was pulling the trigger back, and all of a sudden my hand froze, and this is just for, you know, just the way it happened for me. I was sitting in my room on my knees, leaning over the bed, and I didn't want to make a big mess. It was pitch black in that room, and when I was squeezing that trigger, my hand froze, and then the whole room got bright white. At least it did in my head. And I heard a voice say to me, "How dare you try to take your life? I don't care how bad a parent you are, how bad a husband, how bad a... You will not take yourself away from your children. People care about you." And I was like a big goddamn gummy bear. I sat there on my knees all night and cried. Now, I don't know what you people call that, but I know what it was for me. And it's one of them God incidences that happen around here. Those moments of clarity. And that was not the first time. But, you know, what happened was I went back and I told my significant other and I told my family just before Thanksgiving in 83. I think I have a problem with drinking. They fell off the chairs laughing. Anybody ever be the last one to know? What? You mean you people suspect something? And I seriously had to consider. I had a problem with this booze. It was kicking my ass. So I sat and I thought about it. And I thought about it through Thanksgiving. I was drinking while I was thinking. And I drank through it through Christmas and stuff. If you're a parent, I think some of the worst psychological kicks in the guts you can ever do for your family is things like 7 o'clock in the morning when the kids are coming down to the Christmas tree and you're one more time coming to on the floor in the living room by the tree, and all the kids want to do is see that stuff that Santa left, and they're real excited, you know, and they're coming down and they're sneaking down, and you say, "Get upstairs, old bastards, it's too early." And I mean, they all run up there because they're definitely afraid. And if you got to make amends, I'm telling you, that's sometimes those things are hard to do, but the other side of those are wonderful. But that's the kind of drunk I was. Christmas morning. And You know, so, but I thought some more about it, and then I figured it out. I got to do something about it. Right there after Christmas, I have to do something about it. But nobody gets sober before Christmas Eve. I mean, before New Year's Eve. So I had one more New Year's Eve, and then I didn't want to spoil the rest of the month, so I drank for the rest of the month. And some people that really loved me held one of those interventions. I don't know so much if I like that word or not, but people that gave a shit about me cornered me, and they confronted me about my drinking. And I took that infamous 20 question test, and I got a 19, and I was very proud. And while I was somewhat pissed off that I had missed one, my sponsor Jack, I used to tell him I was a perfectionist, and Jack says, "You're a goddamn nitpicker," you know. But I was perturbed because I had not got 100 on the test, and then the guy says, "If you got 3 right, you're an alcoholic." I says, "Oh, retest." I didn't have my glasses, you know. But what happened was, make a long story short, they said that I had trouble. I finally admitted I was. And if you're an alcoholic like me, you know that moment of clarity, that moment of truth when you say, "Geez, I am an alcoholic." And boom, it hits home like, whew, I don't know. My whole life started making sense. And I felt like this great weight was lifted off me. And then this guy tried to get me into treatment and all that stuff, and it drug on for a couple of days, and it drug on for like 8 days, and they couldn't get me in, and I had that last drink. I was a wine connoisseur being out here in California. And I couldn't decide if I wanted red, white, or rosé, so I bought a bottle of each. And I sat down at home and I drank 3 bottles of wine. And you know what? Absolutely nothing happened. Absolutely nothing. I just one more time just passed out or whatever it was. When I woke up the next day, all that guilt and all that fear and all that remorse, that understanding that, God damn it, you just admitted a week ago you're an alcoholic, your life's totally unmanageable, and here you are one more time drinking. I ran around my house for about 3 days threatening with people that I was going to go to a meeting, one of them A&A meetings. And my significant other said, "You ain't got a hair on your butt, pal. And if you're a big, tough Marine out there, if you're a big, tough guy, if you're a big, tough anything, no one, especially a significant other, tells you you have no courage." So I jumped on my motorcycle and I did the only one and only wheelie I've ever done right out that goddamn gate. And I wound up Tarmac, or whatever the hell the name of the street is, Charlie Tuck's place. And I snuck in there, and you know, these cruel, cruel bastards. Charlie was standing at the door, and I snuck in with my lights out, and I went underneath the shadow of a tree at night. You know, it was black night, you know, with the motor off. You don't want nobody to see nothing. And I'm putting a bike underneath the shadow of the tree. He says, "Hey, the meeting's over here." I said, "Holy Christ." You know? He's seen me, you know. And, you know, and then once again, I'm talking to the tough guys. You got to put that armor on. You got to puff it up. You know. All right, I'm waiting for that stupid old man at that door to say one stupid thing to me, and I'm going to eat him up. I get to the door, and I'm waiting for him to say something stupid like, "Oh, hello, welcome." He sticks his hand out. He looks right through me. He says, "Welcome home, kid." I got a lump in my throat. I couldn't say a goddamn thing. Because he looked right through me and he knew who he was talking to. And he wouldn't let go of my hand. And Charlie, people that know Charlie know what I'm talking about, the lollipop man. He'd stick a goddamn lollipop in your mouth and he'd drag you over, literally drag you over to the coffee thing, get you a cup of coffee, and then he's dragging me up. You know, I'm not going to argue with an old guy. He's got my hand. And he's got my heart. The same time he grabbed my hand, he grabbed my heart. And he started dragging me around by my heart. And I couldn't, you know, I didn't let him know. And he started bringing me up to the front. He says, "Let's go up and sit in the front, kid." He says, "You don't want to sit in the back in the half measure section." What the hell is that guy? What the hell's a half measure section? So I sat up there. I sat up there, you know. And then the meeting went on, and it was all, you know, it was all magic. And you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. And they started reading the heebie-jeebie stuff that they always read. Heebie-jeebie, heebie-jeebie, heebie-jeebie. I said, "Oh Christ!" You know. Next thing they're gonna go is Dominie Vobiscum or something. Then they says, "Okay, let's see the hands of the newcomers," and everybody's, you know. And then they said, you know, they started talking, you know, says, "Hey, come on up, Mickey, and say something." And the girl got up and says, "My name is Mickey, and I'm an alcoholic." I went, "Oh, Christ! Did she say that?" Yeah, and I was embarrassed for the woman, because there were people there listening. And then she starts reading my mail. I said, oh. And then he says, hey, Joe, come on up, Joe. And Joe says, my name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. I said, oh, Christ, two in a row. And I was embarrassed for these people. But what happened was these people started telling other people my mail, so I knew what had happened. I had mentioned the meeting one time because I looked at a schedule somewhere, and that rotten significant other must have sent notes to all these people, you know, and they had crib sheets on me, you know. So, make a long story short, what happened was, he says, well, let's hear from the newcomer. And I'm sitting there like this. Everybody goes. And I got up here, and I swear, as God is my judge, I got up to the front, and I put the armor back on. I said, I'm an alcoholic, my head's off. And they did the same thing you people were doing. And I did not like that laughter. You know, the first time I opened my mouth in Alcoholics Anonymous and I started telling that sad, sad, tragic tale about that last drink of mine and how desperate I was and my whole life was going down the shitter, these people were laughing. And when I first heard it, I thought they were laughing at me. And then I went to say something else and I heard that laughter again, and then I found out, God, they're laughing with me. My God, what a gift. And what happened was you reached out and you grabbed my heart and said, you sorry son of a bitch, you're going to be all right if you stay here. And I got to tell you, this is just for me. I have felt safe and warm from the first moment I ever came to the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. People that know me know that I am not BSing you about it. If you're new, my God, I hope you stay here. I know that so many people come and they don't stay. And I'm talking too long, but let me tell you about some of the beauty that's happened. 30 days sober, that nutso family that used to run from me if I had a drink, my kids used to hide. They put a bouquet of flowers on my motorcycle. God damn it, don't put flowers on a tough guy's motorcycle. I mean, I have to explain this stuff. My first sponsor, Jack Glassner. Bruce knows who I'm talking about. He sponsors Bruce. Look how good a guy Bruce is. And I don't say that. I'm not sitting here patronizing people. I watch people in this program. I watch the people who talk and walk like they talk. But my sponsor Jack said, I don't care if you don't do anything today, pal. He said, but act better than you really are. And I said, why is that? He said, because that's what we do around here. We grow up around here. And we become responsible, decent, civilized human beings. You know, and we start doing the right thing in spite of our own motives. I said, oh, Christ. He said, yeah, heavy. But, you know, he said to me, when I asked him to be my sponsor, he said, look, he said, I'll be your sponsor. He said, when we're 90 days sober, you will do a fifth step with me, or you will find somebody that wants to play games with you. And I needed a tough guy in my life. And Jack is a tough guy, but he's loving at the same time. He can twist all that tough stuff and make it sound like it's the smartest thing to do. You know, and for me, it happened because I was alcoholic. My first year of sobriety went by just like that. And so did the second and the third and all that. And I'm in the military, and I've been all over the world. And you know what? I've found Alcoholics Anonymous in every place that I've ever been. And the places I haven't, I've found other sick alcoholics like me. We've put groups together. Imagine that. You know? We talk about the terror, the loneliness of this disease. I am never alone. Never. I have a power greater than myself that I trust implicitly with my life. I have a power that I believe I call God. And if you have a hard time with that, newcomers, God, the acronym for God is good orderly direction that you can get from God, a group of drunks. You know, and they're directed by God. Whether you believe in her or not. You know? And yes, I did say her. You know? I'm tired of all this macho chauvinist stuff. But it's only my own concept. I figure if God knew what women were like and stuff, he's got to have some insight, so I don't argue that point. A year sober, people gave me a token and a cake. And I said, I didn't do a damn thing except what you told me to do. And they said, yes, but we're proud of you for that. You know? And every day, when I come to these meetings and I say, well, we don't have any special occasions for next week, I said, my God, I think somebody's missing the point. We have 69 reasons in here tonight that are special occasions. If you were sick and desperate and dying from this disease like I was, and the pitiful part of it was you didn't even know it, My God, what a miracle to sit here tonight sober, listen to some idiot up here ramble about how grateful he is to be alive. You know, the birthday people. You know, what better thing could we do with our lives than become decent, civilized, sober, caring human beings? You know, there was never a time when I drank where I really gave a shit about anybody. There was never a time when I drank where I knew how to connect with you. I mean, I'm a family man, and I couldn't even connect with my own children. If you had children, you know what I mean. Or if you come from a dysfunctional family, you want to love people so badly, and you don't know how to touch them. You don't have an ability to do that. Today, I cry at the drop of a hat. I've been in the Marine Corps almost 30 years, on and off. The idiots are about ready to promote me again. You know? I've gone from an enlisted man, from a private, to the officer ranks. I am a senior chief warrant officer of Marines, and I'm very proud of all that stuff. But I could not have accomplished any of that stuff without the gift of sobriety, by the grace of God, by a program of recovery described in this big blue book, you know. And it's not me. I don't do anything any different than anybody else I know that's successful in this program. I work at it. And I don't want you to sit in these meetings. You know, this is your own thing, but you can sit in a meeting and drink coffee for an hour every night. I guarantee your sobriety is not going to be working too good. Your ass is going to start falling off, and you're going to say, holy shit, this ain't it either. But Alcoholics Anonymous is the solution for this alcoholic. This is the treatment that I take for that disease, and it works every time I apply it. There's a lot of other wonderful stuff I want to tell you, but once again, I run over time because... I don't know, but I know you know this, but I'm just going to repeat this. I was one of those drunks that came here and I knew all the answers, except my answers weren't working anymore. And what happened was I found all the answers I need are in this program, in this book. And I'm going to read two things, if you'll bear with me. One of them is on 164, and it says... It talks about the book, and it says it's meant to be suggestive only. I don't know any other book that's ever worked any more well for any alcoholic than this one. But it says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. That's steps 1, 2, and 3. It says, admit your faults to Him and to your fellows, 4, 5, 6, and 7. Clear away the wreckage of your past, 8, 9, 10. God will give freely of what you find and join us, 11 and 12. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as we trudge the happy road to destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. This other thing I wanted to read, and if you bear with me, and it's called Sober Guy. And I know there was an idiot standing out at the Thursday meeting 2 weeks ago wearing a costume, Sober Guy. But... What I did do is I had, if any of the people out there my age remember the old George Reeves Superman in black and white with Phyllis Coates as Lois, you know, and they'd have dun da 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 da. Okay, so now if you can think of that music, the old Superman theme, it's look up in the front, it's a newcomer, it's an old timer. No, it's Sober Guy. Sober Guy, strange visitor from a once destructive lifestyle with powers and abilities far beyond those of practicing alcoholics. Faster than the glow of 100-proof booze on an empty stomach. Dun, 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 dun. More powerful than the guilt and remorse that almost drove him to insanity. Able to live life on life's terms one day at a time. Sober Guy, who had to change the course of his sodden existence. Bend the knee to a loving God as he understood him, and who, disguised as Robert Edward Prieto, mild-mannered Marine from Camp Pendleton, California, fights a never-ending battle for sobriety, spirituality, and the AA way of life. I thank you.